Today is March the 14th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of this program is available on wbai.org/archive and prn.fm and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are slightly different. We note with sadness, British scientist Stephen Hawking passed away at age 76. He was diagnosed with motor neurons disease in 1963 and went on to shape modern cosmology. Stephen Hawking is the author of A Brief History of Time, which was an international bestseller. He is regarded as one of the most brilliant theoretical physicists since Albert Einstein. In the news this evening, right-to-repair legislation that is pending in 18 states. Google now has three Android configurations, Android, Android Go, and Android One. Android P is being released. And then we're going to look at, what do you select, Android or iPhone? Let's get on with the show. Recent announcement that California has pending legislation on right to repair, and there's 17 other states that has pending legislation, although none of it has passed yet, with 18 states advocating on right to repair.
What do you mean by right to repair? Of course I have the right to repair anything that I own.
Well, what they're saying is that, and if you looked at the proposed legislation, they're all saying that right to repair means that information has to be available on how, and also parts also have to be available to enable you to do it.
So you're saying once I buy a product from Company A, Company A has the responsibility to provide me with all of the information I need to repair their product. That would include a tech manual, that would include either tools or the description of tools that would be necessary, would be schematics, whatever is necessary.
And to make it available, if there's a cost, that it's a modest cost, that not something outrageous, like $1 million for this schematic. There's a real cost involved in reproducing it. Well, they should be able to charge that nominal cost.
What about spare parts?
Same thing with spare parts, or allow third party to make the spare parts available. And as you know, in the car market, you can buy third party spare parts readily, like batteries and so on. You don't have to get the original battery that came with the car. There's many batteries which are compliant with the specs required. In other words, if it meets specs, it should be acceptable.
Don't really have a problem on either side of that. My question is, they provide me, the manufacturer provides me with a schematic, with a place to buy the replacement parts, and as a result, I basically break the phone or the computer. Do they have any responsibility to fix what I just broke?
No, unless if you were negligent, the answer is no.
How do you know if I was negligent?
Well,
I could have broken it, but not with the negligence. No, the point I'm making, rather, is if my smartphone is put together basically without replaceable parts, that is, the battery is a film battery, it doesn't have a battery case around it, the motherboard, so it's not meant to be repaired, there's no way even to for me to easily open it up to discover that I shouldn't have opened it. How does that work in that case?
That's very easy. In other words, suppose you have a problem with your iPhone and Apple says we can fix it. Then if they can fix it, then whatever means they use should be made available to a third party. And that's what these states are proposing with the legislation. If you can repair it and someone else says, well, I could find someone so I can repair it at a lower cost. They're saying make it available.
All right. So you're saying this is not necessarily do it yourself, but this is opening up to third party repair services.
Right. Or if you want to do it yourself and you have the capability of doing it, like
as you mentioned on the air a couple of years ago, you had an Acer notebook and you went on YouTube. You found out what part was needed and you watched YouTube step by step how to do it, and you did it yourself.
And indeed, I bought the keyboard. It was a keyboard that malfunctioned, and I bought it from a third party that I had found on the net. And when I got the keyboard, I found it was manufactured by the same factory and had the same part number as the one I had taken out of the Acer. Although, in other words, the factory was selling them direct to third-party people. That I appreciate. But Acer, when they designed and built the laptop, it was built with a replaceable keyboard, replaceable hard disk, replaceable memory, and once I was shown how on YouTube how to open the case without breaking anything, it was all available to me. But suppose it was designed...
Wait, Joe, let me stop you right there. And you got your instructions on YouTube because someone posted it, but assuming that there was no maintenance manual to tell you to change the part, how would you feel about it? And it's not on YouTube.
Well, that's sort of the point, Hank. If it's doable, you'll find it on YouTube. There's several million YouTube films loaded every week. It's the most important part of YouTube, which was, I think, purchased by Google. The most important part of that is their index. I can look up anything and quickly find the pictures or the if there is one. What I'm saying is, suppose it was designed not to be opened. Now, the factory under warranty would either try to open it and rebuild it. They have the ability in factory to rebuild it, or they would replace it with another machine that they had repaired and rebuilt. To say that that has to be made, that service has to be made available to everybody, I think is unreasonable.
Well, let me put it this way. You have the other extreme where, let's take Apple. They say you want the spare parts, you got to go through their authorized dealers or actually, in their case, order from us directly. You can't use a third party.
For a long time, that's what General Motors did with their Delco division. But if a third party found it was profitable to develop the spare parts, they would. Now, indeed, that's what happened. They found that it would be profitable to replace batteries. So there are numerous battery companies with General Motors type or General Motors compatible batteries. They said that basically an oil filter is a replaceable or a consumable item. So there are three or four or five different oil filter companies now out there. But there weren't when that very first General Motors car came out. This was developed later. If I want to replace, for the sake of argument, let's say the door handle on a 1952 Chevy, there's no third party to go to. I have to go to a junkyard and find a junked 1952 Chevy that I can take the door handle off of. And incidentally, I picked that because that's exactly what I did.
Well, let me pick a different example, Joe. The iPhone 6 S, okay, that's a good example. In changing the battery, the Apple cost is $79.95 or something like that. And they said that because of the PR flack with about, you know, how they've been, you know, talking about degrading the battery and all that, and they didn't really degrade the battery. They just, you know, give it try to lengthen the life of the battery in terms of recharge. But they say, okay, we'll replace the battery at $29.95, and basically that's the cost of the battery, and then they're eating the cost of the labor. But if it was like a typical model that you know, you have to go to Apple, instead of $79.95. A third party says, we'll do it for $50. Why can't I order the battery for $29.95 and do it myself?
Actually, you can, but not from Apple.
Well, my point is Apple does not make it available to you because it's a customized battery.
Yeah, but there are some third parties that are now in China now producing that battery.
But Apple says only authorized people can get that. See, that's part of the problem. Well, let me ask you, overall, with this proposed legislation and maybe with some modification about under what conditions you favor right to repair legislation?
Under the right conditions, and if they hired somebody competent to write the law, which they don't normally do.
Google offers its Android mobile operating system in three different configurations. Android, the one that you're more familiar with, Android Go, and Android One. The last two are aimed at budget systems. Google unveiled Android Go as a stripped-down version of Android 8.1 Oreo, optimized to work on smartphones running on 1 gigabyte of RAM or less. Google sees most of these devices costing less than $100. Case in point, the ZTE Tempo Go was announced and it sells for less than $80, while the Nokia One should go on sale soon for less than $85. Android Go as an operating system was designed to take up less space on the phone, and even if these devices were shipped out with only 8 gigabytes of storage, there's still going to be plenty of free space left. Go devices will come with Google Play Store installed, but install with a host of Go Edition apps like Google Search Go, Gmail Go, YouTube Go, or a Google Assistant Go, lightweight versions of the fully-fledged apps. Android One encompasses a more controlled vision of what Android for budget phones should be like. Android One programs are bound to receive updates faster and offer a clean stock Android experience without additional bloatware. Android Go is a bit more flexible, allowing OEMs to bundle some of their own apps on board. Additionally, any carrier or manufacturer can use Android Go and sell the devices in any market.
Android P is soon to be released. In fact, beta is already out, and they're going to be saying it will be available by the end of March. And P, I don't know what fruit it's going to stand for. It could be pineapple, it could be peaches, who knows what it is. Are you going to be one of the first early adopters, or are you going to say, I'm going to hold off?
The odds are, since I have a phone that's manufactured under the control of and is primary product of Google, which is the Android, I have an Android Pixel. And as with the N and O versions of Android, it was initially put out for these phones first, I'll probably be an early adopter. And stay tuned if it's really got things to complain about. Tune in. I'll be one of the first complaining about it.
I had sent you a reference article where Google is selling refurb Pixels for $240. You have any thoughts about it? Because you know the Pixel 2 will come out and there'll probably be some replacement, but the $240 is a lot less than what you paid for. Is it still a viable product to consider to purchase?
Well, here's the thing. The Pixel 2 has come out, and from a hardware point of view, I personally don't think it's that much different from the Pixel 1. There are some significant changes. But since the Pixel 2 is out at basically the price that the Pixel 1 was sold for, what they've done is they, both for existing inventory and on factory refurbs, they've cut the price on the Pixel 1 totally. If when I was ready to buy, I could have gotten the Pixel 1 for the prices they're offering it today versus the Pixel 2 offering today, I would have gone with the Pixel 1. But that's me, and you know that I've consistently, I think, not been the first, what do they call it, to live on the bleeding edge. I don't do that normally. I did get the Pixel 1 because I wanted to see what a Android, basically what an Android phone would be if there was no additional involvement of the manufacturer. All the other phones that run Android are people who licensed Android and changed it. It's no longer the plain vanilla version. I was curious. Am I happy that I expressed that curiosity? No, I am not. I am sorry that I bought the Pixel 1. There's been some changes. Three times they've downloaded patches and changes and full changes to me. And now it's probably much better, but there are still some hardware problems that I have that are basically untraceable. Is it because of the manufacturer, because of the developing hardware or the software? I have no way of knowing. There are things that I cannot reproduce that happened in the middle of the night. The do not disturb feature will turn itself on or off for no reason that I can see. There are other things like that, minor software things that are just bizarre.
When people say they want to buy a smartphone, some will ask you Android or iPhone. Others would say, I want an iPhone. Now, what can I get on it? Or I want an Android. What can I get on it?
No, they don't even do that. Some people say, I want an iPhone, and whatever Apple has given them, that's what they want. Other people will say, I want a Samsung, or I want a Sony, or I want one of the other ones that are made in China. And they take whatever they're given. And the reason they end up liking or not liking that phone is what is on the phone when they buy it. And if they didn't like what Samsung gave them this time, they'll never buy another Samsung. So in many ways, Apple has an advantage over their competition because they know automatically that's what their customers expect. Whatever they get, they expect, that's what they expect.
Well, in your household, one has an iPhone, the other has an Android. How do you coexist?
Well, every time I curse my Android and every time it does something I don't want it to do, my wife says, I told you to buy an Apple. Every time her phone doesn't do something she expects, she says, show me how to do it. In other words, she will automatically think it's her fault, never the phone's fault. My problem with the iPhone is that after all of these years, Android appears to me to be very intuitive, and the iPhone appears to be very esoteric.
Now, wait a minute. We're told that the Apple products are all very intuitive.
And they are the people who are used to that platform. I said to Joanna one day, I was looking at her phone, looking at a picture on her phone, and I said, how do I go back a page? And she had no idea. On the average Android smartphone, there's an arrow, and you want to go back, you press the arrow. Which is more intuitive? I think the Android is much more intuitive. She thinks that the Android is very esoteric and that her phone is intuitive. It's a religion. Hank, you're one religion, I'm another religion. Which one is correct? Well, obviously, I'll tell you which one is correct. It's me.
Yeah, I know. It's when I talk politics with you, you know that you're always right on the one that you advocate. And if I advocate anything different, I'm wrong. And
absolutely. I'm glad after all these years, after 40 years, you finally realize the truth of that.
Yeah, the truth is, I know you're wrong because you're the contrarian.
And the truth is, you know I'm right because even you just said I was.
This evening, we have a number of feature segments, starting with Wearable and Health Technologies by Dr. Alfred Poor. Smart thermometer data predicts flu outbreaks. Standard webcam can monitor heartbeats. And smartphone app gets FDA clearance to diagnose autism in children. And from the Tech Corner, Joe King and myself, well, we're going to be talking about an inconvenient Linux operating system truth. And on the home automation front, Marty Winston is going to tell us what he does with all that data, with all that sensor information and status readings, and what does he do with it in a relational database.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
This year's flu season seems to be hanging on, and we've got another flu story for you. Recently, we talked about the study that one smart thermometer manufacturer did, and they were able to determine when a flu outbreak occurred, and they were able to determine that weeks before the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, was able to do it. Well, now we have a new study that's come out of the University of Iowa. They looked at historical data from many different smart thermometers, and what they were able to do was correlate it with the actual outbreaks of flu in different areas. They used an artificial intelligence engine to perform the analysis, sort of a machine learning kind of application. It was able to come up with insights and determinations about how to predict flu activity. And in fact, they are able to take data from smart thermometers, and they are able to predict where a flu outbreak will occur 3 weeks before it even happens. That's amazing. Before it even happens, 3 weeks ahead of time, they know where the flu is going to be a problem. This could have enormous ramifications. It could help us determine where to ship flu medicines, especially the antivirals that tend to be in short supply when a big flu outbreak happens, and can help gear up the medical personnel and the healthcare system to be ready for the outbreak when it occurs. And the result could be that we'd have a much more efficient, much more effective way of treating the flu when, in fact, the outbreak occurs. So here's another example of how big data is able to find the needles in the haystack and come up with some very useful information out of all the digital data that our systems are creating. New parents have so much to worry about, especially when it's their first baby. They're always wondering, you know, is the baby getting a good rest? How's their heart rate? How are they breathing? All those kinds of things that can give them lots of concern. Some companies have addressed this problem by coming up with wearables for babies, patches or anklets or different kinds of devices that can monitor the baby's movements and heartbeat and so forth. There's a problem that they move around, they may not be comfortable, and you have to attach something to the baby's body in order for it to work. A better system would be one that doesn't make contact with the child at all. That's exactly what some Utah State University researchers have come up with. They found that they can use an ordinary webcam, standard webcam like you'd use for video chat, and they are able to have it watch a baby, and it is able to detect tiny, tiny changes in color. And those changes in color are caused as the blood in the skin increases and decreases in relationship to the heartbeat. So if you think about it, I mean, this is very minute observations, calculations that are being done. And yet these cameras, just off-the-shelf cameras, are sensitive enough to do that. So all they need to do is see any exposed skin on the infant, and this system should be able to monitor the heartbeat while it's working. This is kind of cool. It's a low-cost system. It's non-contact. It doesn't have to touch the baby and can give parents peace of mind. Before I get to this next story, I just want to make a couple observations about technology and our lives. It's amazing to me how some of these incredible inventions have had implications and repercussions far beyond anything that anybody could have imagined. The example that I like to use is back when the original personal computers came out, the first Apple II and the Radio Shack Model 3 and the IBM PC, when those first came out, I don't think anybody ever had the concept that they would end up being used for mining digital currency, as is being done with Bitcoin and other currencies today. Just nobody could have imagined that. And by the same token, I think that we originally wanted to have a telephone that we could put in our pocket and walk around in or out of our home and be able to send or receive telephone calls anytime we wanted. And that's how the cell phone was born. And that was a very cool thing, and it was very liberating, and it made our lives very, very different. But I don't think anybody, when those first phones came out, looked at them and said, oh, yeah, this is going to be a device that can diagnose disease. And yet that's exactly where we are. There's already software, not hardware, but just software programs that are approved by the FDA for medical purposes to either diagnose or treat an illness or chronic condition, smoking cessation, weight loss, support for diabetes care. There's just a lot of these applications that are out there. There's a new one out that I find particularly interesting. One of the big fears that parents have is they wonder whether or not their child is developing properly, both physically and mentally. It's a bit scary because there's no good way to know, you know, you haven't seen thousands of babies, so you don't know if whether or not your child is slow in learning how to talk or interact with people or slow to recognize faces. You just don't really have a measure of what's the norm and whether your child is inside or outside that range. Well, there's a company called Cognoa, and they have built a platform that can use a smartphone application to analyze behavioral traits for children. It's designed for very young children from about 1 to 8 years old. But the big news here is that their system just received FDA clearance as a Class 2 medical diagnostic device. This is a smartphone app, and basically what it does is it asks parents a series of questions about their child, how they behave at home under normal circumstances, questions about speech, about their play activities, and things like that. And based on an artificial intelligence analytics engine that has looked at enormous numbers of clinical records for children, this application is then able to diagnose the child and say whether or not the behavior is within normal ranges or whether there's a possibility of autism. Not only can it diagnose autism, but it can diagnose it in children as young as a year and a half old. The average diagnosis under normal circumstances for autism is a bit over 4 years old. So this catches it much earlier. And one of the things that healthcare professionals say is that the earlier you can catch it, the earlier you can begin treatment, you can minimize the impact of the condition, and treatment can be much more effective. So it's fascinating to me how a device that was originally designed to just help us make phone calls has morphed into this platform that is capable of doing amazing things, including diagnosing diseases and chronic conditions right in the palm of your hand.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. An inconvenient truth about Linux as a personal computing system.
As a personal computer system, why hasn't Linux taken hold?
There's a couple of reasons, in my opinion, Hank. One of them, and perhaps the biggest, is when you say Linux, you're really referring only to the kernel, the piece developed by Linus Torvalds, which has been adopted by I don't know how many hundreds of different developers and systems. If I said to you, I'm using Linux, your first question to me would be, which Linux? There are hundreds of what are called distros or distributions, which are very different and have different capabilities. Somebody buys a computer with a system in it, they want to be able to use it day one. And with Linux, that's not always possible. The tools are different. The applications that are available in it are different. The front end is different, so it looks different. It's not practical to say, I want Linux. You have to say, I want Debian, or I want another distro. And then you have to, once you have it, you have to see if there are sufficient programs to support it for you and sufficient tools.
Many of us have had orphan systems that just sit idle. We call it a doorstop. By orphan systems, I mean machines that are too slow to run Windows 10 or even Windows 7. They may be leftovers from XP days. They are still functional. You would like to donate it or give it to someone who can appreciate access to a working computer. Linux as an operating system works very well with legacy hardware. So why isn't Linux having greater popularity in the installed base of computer systems? No one really has an accurate number of installed systems, but based on web access, The following represents active online operating systems in use. The biggest one is Android. Over 40% of operating systems on the web is Android. Windows is a close second with 36.5% of systems. iOS is about 13%. Mac OS X is about 5.5%. And Linux is 0.66%. That's very, very low. Linux has been available since 1992. If you heard anything at all about Linux, you've probably heard about Linux distributions, often shortened and called Linux distros. When deciding to use Linux as a desktop computer, you first need to choose a distro. Linux works differently. The Linux operating system isn't produced by a single organization. Different organizations and people work on different parts of it. There's a Linux kernel, the core of the operating system. The GNU shell utilities, which are the terminal interface and many of the commands you use. The X server, which produces a graphical desktop. The desktop environment, which runs on the X server to provide a graphical desktop, and many more other system services, graphical programs, and terminal commands, which are developed independently from each other. They are all open source software distributed in source code form. If you wanted to, you could get the source code for the Linux kernel, GNU shell utilities, Xorg, Xserver, and every other program on the Linux system, assemble them yourself. However, compiling the software would take a lot of time, not to mention the work involved with making all the different programs work properly together. So when you want to install new software or update for new versions of a software with important security updates, your Linux distribution provides them in pre-compiled package form. These packages are fast, easy to install, and saving you from doing the hard work yourself. Many also use different package managers, configuration utilities, and other software. Some distributions are bleeding edge and won't receive support for very long. Others, such as Ubuntu LTS or Red Hat Enterprise Linux, are designed to be stable distributions that will be supported with security updates and bug fixes for many years. Some Linux distributions are intended for desktop computers, and some are for servers without a graphical interface, and others for special applications. But as most Linux desktop users will eventually discover, there comes a time when you just need to run a particular piece of Windows software on your Linux PC. There are quite a few ways to do so, and here's what you need to know. Linux is a free operating system. You can pick and choose what option you want. There are many variations to the graphical user interface. There are applications that will run on many different platforms. There are applications that are equivalent to what is available under Windows and Mac OS X. Most Linux distros will run on older equipment. You can even test run the distro before you install it on your hard disk drive or solid state drive. So what is there not to like about it? Well, if you have a need for an application that is not available across different platforms, an example of this is a tax preparation program. Yes, you can do it online, but that's for simple 1040EZ returns. Anything more than that, you need the application itself. If you have a 401k or other retirement plans, the simple 1040EZ return is insufficient. So we're told there's Wine, and you can use Wine on Linux. Wine is a way to run Windows software on Linux, but with no Windows operating system required. Well, Wine is open source. It's a Windows compatibility layer that can run Windows programs directly on your Linux desktop. Essentially, this open source project is attempting to re-implement enough of Windows from scratch that it can run all those Windows applications without actually needing Windows. But the downside is it won't run every application properly. You may encounter bugs or performance issues. More important is the necessity to install Wine first with each new release of the selected Linux distro. In a mass market product, one cannot assume that the general consumer knows enough to go through this technical machination each time there's a patch or there's a new release. I'm told that if you absolutely need Windows, then get a Windows machine. And that is why the adoption of Linux is only 0.66%. the number of Linux distributions is also declining. Exactly why the declining is taking place and how much it matters remains somewhat unclear. In fact, DistroWatch had at one time listed almost 800 distributions, and this was at its founding in 2001. Although less than 40% have ever been in active development at any given time. These tallies may not be complete, since some distribution probably never registered with DistroWatch, but they are pretty accurate as anyone is likely to offer, so now we're down to under 300 distros. So what's happening? Part of the reason for the decline may be that Linux is becoming less a hobby and more of a business strategy, where hobbyists may tinker. Commercial businesses are more concerned with results, specifically in decreasing time to market and lowering development costs. With these concerns, businesses are less likely to experiment for experiment's sake and more likely to base their development on an existing concern. Perhaps Linux supporters are also aging and, like businesses, have become less time for hobbies and more concerned with immediate results. However, statistics about such a diverse group makes this possibility impossible to confirm. Another reason for the decline of Linux may be that the center of innovation has shifted in recent years from distribution to the desktop. Although most distributions have a default desktop, most of the major ones offer at least a dozen desktop environments, many of which encourage different work habits in users. Except for branding, wallpaper, and themes, it's usually easier these days to tell at a glance what desktop you're logged into than what distribution you're using, because of the almost universal tendency towards graphical package installation. You cannot even tell easily what package management system you are using, let alone the distribution. The odds are, however, that the technology you're using is Debian. At least part of the decline in distribution may be that Debian technology dominates. The number based upon Debian or its most popular derivatives, Ubuntu, has gone from 63% of the total number of distributions to now over 70%. This decline is so small that it may represent a statistical blip rather than a trend. At the very least, Debian derivatives are disappearing more slowly than any other distribution. Whatever the reasons for the decline in distros, it looks as though the frontier is starting to close. Some might say that the decline hardly matters. After all, the current 285 distribution is still more than even the most avid user can hope to try in their lifetime, unless they devote their lives to doing nothing else. Some might say that many of the distributions are so minor and so personal that few people even notice their loss. Their loss could even be a benefit because the fewer distributions mean more contributors to the surviving one. However, despite the disappearance of some promising distributions, few of those have disappeared and could be considered major. As minor distros have disappeared in the last 3 years, the top 10 for page views on DistroWatch has changed little, except to Ryzen 4 a position or two. Still, even if most of the losses have been minor, the trend is disturbing. Linux advocates have always prized diversity, and the loss of even a little diversity seems like a major cause of concern. Even if it proves beneficial in some way, if nothing else, the trend suggests that Linux is straying from its roots and perhaps becoming a lot less adventuresome and more stodgy. What, if anything, could or should be done about the trend is uncertain. It may be desirable to choose an operating system with your choice of graphical user interface and your choice of system components, but the average user is not willing to spend time building the operating system with each new update release. There are so many implementations of Linux with different user interface, each with their different navigation, that the average user has difficulty finding support. Just remember one thing.
People always clamor for, they want to be able to say they want it their way. I guess that's the reason why you have fast food where it only comes in one form and you get in line and you get your burger very quickly. But there are others that say, hey, I want my pasta cooked this way. What you're saying is there are not enough people to create a consumer mass to enable that to be a sustainable market.
Which, using your analogy, is why McDonald's is so big and some of the have-it-your-way places are much smaller.
Assuming that there is some de facto on Linux, my conclusion is that you don't have all the necessary applications that you might need on Linux. And my advice is pick the application you need, and then you find out what operating system it runs on. You don't say, I want an operating system, and what can I run on it?
I agree with you completely, Hank, but I think I'll go further and say the huge majority, maybe as high as 80-90%, people never do pick an operating system. They pick a machine, and they expect that machine to do everything that they want it to do, regardless of operating system.
Wait a second. Did you remember daylight savings time? Did you spring forward? If you have to listen to this show on the stream instead of tuning it in on the radio because it was over before you got here, pause this for a moment and go correct your clocks. I'll give you a second. Okay, I used to talk about an autonomous house or an ultra-automated house. These days, I'm talking about a cybernetic house. That term is not arbitrary. It's the result of suddenly realizing that our setup, our plans, had a missing link that made some big differences in awareness, in memory, in adaptability, and in an ability to learn. One missing link made those differences, and it's something I promised to get into a little deeper, so here goes. It starts, in a way, with lists and logs. Do you have an Excel file somewhere with a list of anything at all? You know, maybe addresses or email addresses or other contact info, maybe passwords, maybe your collection of bubblegum cards, maybe a list of who owes you a drink or money. Humans have been using lists for a very long time and have been keeping lists on computers for a fairly long time. A word processor can keep many kinds of lists. A spreadsheet is nice for lists because they get pretty easy to label and sort. In fact, most spreadsheets have a tool that's just like one I'll describe before this segment is over. In our project house, our cybernetic house, well, it's cybernetic now, we have a lot of things we want to list. All the lights and their current status. All the rooms and their temperatures. All the warm bodies and their locations. Things like that. You may wonder if there's something other than a spreadsheet that's pretty good at managing lists. And yes, there is. You've even heard the term, although not many computer users get very involved with this kind of application software. It handles multiple lists of multiple kinds of data. Did that give it away? It's a database manager. Back before the IBM PC came out, I did my work on a TRS-80. And it had a database manager named Profile, which came out later on the PC as File Pro. It was pretty good because it had a very nice scripting language, and I could get things in one database to look up things from another database. Think of one list looking something up on another list before finishing its automated modifications of the initial list, or something external to that. More than a third of a century ago, my News Tips Bulletin was one of the first, or maybe the first, weekly that was an entirely electronic publication. In the early days, we sent it by MCI mail or fax, both pretty expensive, by getting database scripting and a ton of scripting in a data communications program called Relay. Both of those would do the heavy lifting. You had hundreds of lines of code, a lot of work to make it work, and a lot of little bumps to get past. Now, your takeaway from that is only that these things work, and they're based on lists, and sometimes one list can look up something on another list. All of that evolved, and in a very useful way. For one thing, it squeezed out a ton of repetition. If you say you have a list of a million U.S. mailing addresses, the odds are pretty good that many of them will live in any one particular city and state. Maybe out of the million, you got 20,000 in Pittsburgh and 70,000 in Cleveland and 45 in Illinois or whatever. There's a lot of duplication. So by keeping the city and state data in a separate list, the list of cities and states in a separate list or cities separate from states, also valid. You only have to tokenize those. So the address of John Doe only needs to store a pointer to that city and state. Is that too obscure? Let's use our project house as an example. It has a limited number of rooms, and we can make a list that names the room and describes the room. We can make another list of all the sleeping positions in the room, figure two per bed, and associate each one with an entry on the list of rooms. We can list all the TV sets in the house, associate each one with a room name, and list the name and model number of each set. We can have a separate list of the model numbers and list the codes that a remote control has to send to turn down their volume and turn them off. These lists each have their own elements that may or may not relate to elements in other lists, and the layout of those relationships gives this structure a lot of capabilities. Now, what I just described is called a relational database. Microsoft Access is a relational database. So is Oracle, and there are others. So think about all the lists we might make for a house, your house, my house, any house, and what's in it, and our automation elements and our sensors and all of their readings. All of that. List them all. Of the 100 Raspberry Pi boards in our cybernetic house design, a little over half of them are feeding data into our relational database. A little more than half of the rest are analyzing or responding to the data, and the remainder are dealing with special functions or special interfaces, like fetching online micro weather forecasts or controlling the lighting or irrigation systems. Now, I slid right by something just now. Did you catch it? I mentioned analyzing or responding to the data. Those happen to be two of the critical enhancements that happen when evolving into a cybernetic design. But what does it really mean when we're dealing with the little Raspberry Pi computers with a limited amount of memory? Well, as it happens, moving from flat databases, lists, to relational databases does more than just run duplication through the ringer, a lot more through the really awesomely incredible power of an answer-getting tool called queries. A query can answer questions that span information in every one of the related databases in a relational database system. And the response is, for all intents and purposes, instantaneous. There's a very organized way to ask the information. Might seem a little like writing programming, but it's much easier to learn. Not sure if anyone ever completely masters it, but it's really easy to get the information that you need right now. So even if you happen to ask in a clumsy or inefficient way, that's okay. The way you ask for that information is called structured query language. Pretty self-explanatory, right? Structured query language, also called SQL. And you may have come across that term before. It's often pronounced SQL. I said that Access and Oracle are relational databases, and both let you use SQL to get information out. For that matter, even though not many users ever work or play with it, you can also use SQL inside Excel. Once you learn it, any other method of extracting data seems clumsy and awkward, so lists become databases, and databases become relational, and SQL is kind of the SEAL Team 6 of the data-fetching world. There's one more piece to all of this. Where's the data? Where are we keeping it? What's organizing it? We're not using Oracle or Access or Excel. We're using a time-proven open-source relational database called MySQL. Again, sometimes people will pronounce that MySQL. The MySQL server is the highest horsepower, most mission-critical computer in our entire cybernetic house design. That doesn't mean we're overtaxing it. I said before that the more intelligent the endpoints, the more intelligent the system. And another really important attribute of our cybernetic system design is the intelligence of its nodes. One major benefit of that is in the nodes only reporting data that changes. We use the term news for that. System-wide, for example, our sensors are taking 20,000 temperature measurements, temperature alone, 20,000 every second. But thanks to that filtering for just news, only a few hundred at most are likely to be forwarded to the MySQL server. If and when we ever need to display a floor plan of the house that shows the location of adults, children, infants, pets, or hotspots, the Raspberry Pi that drives the display can get all of that information in one query. If you were able to follow all that about databases and relational databases and queries and MySQL Server, congrats. And for everybody else, this has been one of the geekiest things that I'll ever want to explain here. But there is something I should mention about the computer running MySQL Server. It has redundant dual power supplies. One power supply fails, nothing stops. It has a drive array that can suffer two disk failures without any data loss. It also creates its own spare copy backup on an external drive, and the whole thing is powered through a big UPS with a generator behind it. So when Hank reminds you to backup, 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 well, that's not even the half of it for a critical system like this. Like Hank, it's a key element.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the tri-state northeast area. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on must-have utilities for your computer. Thursday, March the 22nd, 6:45 p.m. is the starting time of the meeting at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC's Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, March the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will be meeting Tuesday, April 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on different categories of artificial intelligence. Thursday, April 5th, meeting time 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, April the 6th with a presentation on home automation. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, April the 10th, meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Silver Building at NYU in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have their meeting on Friday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. The meetings at the computer clubs are all free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there. And TCF 2018 is March the 17th, Saturday. It is a computer festival featuring talks, workshops, and vendors. The theme of the festival this year is wearable technologies. It will be held at the College of New Jersey from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, the website is tcf-nj.org. The keynote speaker is Dr. Nick Van Terheden. Dr. Nick is a leader in digital healthcare and innovation and former chief medical officer for Dell. The feature speaker is George Harris with a presentation on medical tricorders, taking science fiction into reality. I hope to be seeing you at the festival. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and remember, backup, backup, and of course, backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.